she had bruises from going through the glass table or whatever.
Well, I found it to be very consistent. And, you know, the degree of her trauma, like, there's no doubt in my mind that something happened to her that night.
Mm-hmm.
As Erdely conceded in that interview, she told the story from Jackie's point of view. But that part where Erdely said she checked with virtually all of Jackie's friends, that turned out not to be true. Rolling Stone had not contacted the three friends Jackie said she confided in, two of whom came off very badly in the piece. Erdely and her editors decided to protect Jackie's emotional fragility by not interviewing them. Those friends would later offer very different accounts. Here's what Will Dana, managing editor of Rolling Stone, has to say now.
Decisions that we made about this story are very different than decisions we make about pretty much every other story that we've done in all the years that I've been here. You know, out of what seemed like deference to someone who had been a victim of a terrible trauma.
Dana says he didn't anticipate the whirlwind response to the magazine's story when it was published or his sickening feeling when it started to collapse.
We actually would have protected this girl much better by reporting on her story the same way we reported anything else. Because if we had, you know, sort of pulled these things a little harder, done more to verify things that she was saying, I think, you know, we would have saved her a lot of grief and ourselves.
Rolling Stone had assigned false names to Jackie's friends in the piece and to her alleged attacker. But it did not reveal that it had not so much as identified any of them, nor did it tell readers that the narration of the rape and Jackie's exchanges with those friends were based solely on her account. In early December, the Washington Post published a piece contradicting pivotal elements of the article, and Rolling Stone started to back away from it. Columbia Journalism Dean Steve Call.
It's hard to avoid the conclusion that this was just a convenient way to essentially paper over the gap that they had allowed to develop in their own reporting and not make themselves accountable for it with readers.
Rolling Stone managing editor Will Dana apologized for the story last night and officially withdrew it. He says he's issued clearer guidelines for what constitutes good reporting and editing. But he praised his team as good journalists and said there will be no punishments of Erdely, her editor Sean Woods, the fact checkers, nor anyone else. Dana says he doesn't want this fatally compromised article to be the work that defines them. David Folkenflik, NPR News, New York.
And the severe drought here in California has urban areas under intense pressure. Last week, Governor Jerry Brown demanded deep cuts to the water being used by nearly all Californians. In the city of Long Beach, near Los Angeles, a new crackdown on water waste could offer solutions for other cities. From member station KPCC, Molly Peterson reports.
Sprinklers still cascade across green lawns most mornings at the Gold Star Manor Retirement Home in Long Beach, but not for long. Crews are killing 92,000 square feet of grass with a spray herbicide. A rebate from the city of Long Beach will pay for drought-tolerant plants. Terry Geiling is the CEO of the manor. He says he's no tree hugger, but he's not blind to the state's water woes.
It's not going to get much better. This is desert. We never worried about the water before, so it's up to us to take the lead to do that.
Other city incentives will help replace toilets and fixtures. In a few years, Geiling expects updates indoors and out to cut his water use by almost a third.
This is the way everybody should be working.
Overall, Long Beach has reduced its consumption of water 6% since the drought started. But not everybody hears the conservation message this city of 460,000 is sending. So the Long Beach Water Department's general manager, Kevin Wattier, says he's turning up the volume.
We've gotten to the point now where this drought is so serious and our credibility as a utility is in question that we can no longer put up with flagrant abusers of our prohibited uses of water.
The water department issued its first fine ever last month.
Hi, what can I get for you?
It was to a McDonald's, $800. Workers videotaped blasting sprinklers around the restaurant in the middle of the night, pooling water on the drive-through lane. But city crews didn't lie in wait to catch McDonald's. Instead, Long Beach installed a smart meter there. Wattier says this new weapon against waste snaps on where the traditional number-spinning meter goes. It records how much water is used every 5 minutes, and cell phone technology sends usage data to the cloud.
We can just selectively put these in only where we need them. You know, the next day we're getting data from these customers. It'll be so powerful, you can't believe it.
powerful because it's relatively cheap and easy to deploy. And because Wattier says a lot of waste is accidental. Smart meters reveal leaky pipes, teenagers who take too long showers, and sprinkler systems with faulty settings. So when people see what they're doing, they change. He shows me data from a former scofflaw.
This one's down about 80% from when we put the smart meter on and let them know that we were watching what they were doing.
This targeted enforcement program makes Long Beach unique, says Max Gomberg with the State Water Resources Control Board.
It's one of the high achievers, if you will. And I think it's because Long Beach has been willing to act quickly and be innovative.
Early metering efforts have been in place long enough to either change people's ways or rack up fines. The water department is eyeing even more wasteful users, and it's expanding the smart meter program, snapping them on for customers interested in new technology. One of them is Gary DeLong, who already took out his back lawn.
There's a lot more we could do to reduce our footprint, and we need to start doing it.
By next February, California cities together are supposed to cut their water use by a quarter. Sacramento, San Francisco, and some Central Valley cities are also seeing whether smart meters can help. For NPR News, I'm Molly Peterson in Los Angeles.
And to Syria now, the self-proclaimed Islamic State, or ISIS, is edging towards taking over territory just outside the capital, Damascus. That area, called Yarmouk, was once a Palestinian refugee camp. It grew into a busy working-class neighborhood with schools and offices, but for the past 4 years, the area has been a battleground between Syrian government troops and rebels. NPR's Alice Fordham reports that if ISIS takes Yarmouk, it will be the closest they have come to holding turf in the capital.
For 6 days now, ISIS fighters have been battling a patchwork of armed factions for control of the area. One of their unofficial news agencies aired footage of the gunfire we're hearing, which included video of ISIS fighters calling for people to be patient, saying it would all be over soon. Yarmouk residents sending updates via satellite internet suggest multiple groups with shifting alliances are fighting. Some Palestinian militias are pushing back against ISIS, while there are reports Syria's al-Qaeda affiliate Jabhat al-Nusra is helping them. Nusra denies this. Salim Salama, a former resident of Yarmouk and head of the Palestinian League of Human Rights, says it's just not possible to tell who holds sway right now because the fighting is so heavy. What he does know is that civilians are suffering.
People have no food since 4 days. They have no drinking water since 4 days as well. People are starving in their houses. People are thirsty in their houses.
Speaking by Skype from Sweden, he says the 18,000 civilians left in the camp were already weak after the two-year siege. He's worked with Amnesty International to document 200 deaths from lack of food during the siege. The UN arm that works in the camp hasn't been able to distribute aid due to the violence. Alice Fordham, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It's 8:18. You're listening to Morning Edition. Millions of Americans get a physical exam each year, but we'll hear from one professor who says there's little evidence it does much good.
I would argue that we should move forward with the elimination of the annual physical.
We'll hear the argument for doing away with the annual physical at 8:33. Our weather today, overcast with scattered snow in the north, light rain in the south, and most highs in the lower 40s.
Support for WGTD comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Andrea's, a proud supporter of programming on WGTD HD.
And her roots in Appalachian folk and Piedmont blues. WPR is pleased to support music that celebrates America's roots. For more information, visit wpr.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. As Congress studies a framework nuclear agreement with Iran, President Obama tells the New York Times that he reserves executive authority to enter into binding agreements with foreign powers without congressional approval. Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman Bob Corker doesn't agree with that approach. Speaking on Fox News Sunday, the Tennessee Republican said he fully expects lawmakers to have a say.
That doesn't mean that there won't be a deal. We've just set in place a process to ensure that if there's a deal,
It's a deal that will stand the test of time, Senate. That will keep Iran from getting a nuclear weapon.
The deadline for international parties to the framework to finalize the deal is June 30th. Kenya's Air Force has bombed two al-Shabaab camps in Somalia, the first major military response to a terror attack on a university in Kenya. Meanwhile, the Kenyan government is rejecting accusations that its security agencies were too slow to respond last Thursday at Garissa University. Here's the BBC's Emmanuel Agunza.
Local media has been dominated by reports that special forces involved in the operation experienced hours of travel delays. There are also allegations that police failed to act on information provided about one of the gunmen, Abdirahim Abdullahi. He is a lawyer and son of a local chief in the northeast of the country.
At least 148 people died in that attack. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell. Two people are dead after they shot each other outside a Milwaukee bar early Sunday morning. A brother of one of the shooters was caught in the crossfire, but his injury is not believed to be life-threatening. Police were already investigating four separate shootings that happened within 90 minutes of each other Saturday afternoon. In those shootings, four men were left wounded. Police in Madison say they have a plan in place no matter how tonight's national championship men's basketball game goes. Thousands of fans filled the streets on Saturday night after the Badgers' upset win over Kentucky in the semifinals. Moments after the victory, the streets were flooded with celebrating people. There were no arrests, reports of any property damage, or significant incidents. Only one accidental minor injury was reported. That contrasts with more than 30 people arrested in Lexington, the home of the University of Kentucky. Madison police say they're anticipating similar crowds tonight after the title game. The plan also involves the Dane County Sheriff's Department and the University of Wisconsin Police. Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett says the city and county together will come up with $50 million for a downtown arena to replace the BMO Harris Bradley Center. Barrett says he's spoken with Milwaukee County Executive Chris Abley about working together on a new home for the Bucks. The NBA says if a new arena is not built or at least close to completion by 2017, the Bucks would be free to sell or move the team. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Abrams, publisher of the Diary of a Wimpy Kid series and the hosts of a live webcast with author Jeff Kinney on April 27th. More information is available at wimpykid.com. From CFP, on behalf of Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to the highest standard in personal financial advice to help plan major life events and reaching financial goals at letsmakeaplan.org. From Vital Projects Fund, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in New York City, presenting the exhibition One Way Ticket, Jacob Lawrence's Migration Series and Other Visions of the Great Movement North, now through September 7th. More at MoMA.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. There are two more games left in the Division I college basketball season. One we expect to be close and exciting. The other we hope will be. Tonight, Wisconsin plays Duke for the men's championship. That's the one that should be a doozy. Tomorrow, the women's title. That's the one where we hope Notre Dame can challenge mighty Connecticut. NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman joins us now to talk about both games. Good morning.
Hello, Renee.
And if you allow me, we will begin with the women. The championship game was set at yesterday's Final Four when UConn dominated Maryland and Notre Dame won a thriller against South Carolina. Quickly review those games.
Yeah, what a thriller. Notre Dame and South Carolina went back and forth all night. The winning basket Notre Dame scored with just 18 seconds left, and so the Irish won 66-65. UConn beat Maryland 81-58, kind of ho-hum. Forward Morgan Tuck, who usually doesn't dominate statistically, did in this one with 24 points and 9 rebounds. So now it's on to the title game. These same two teams were in it last year. Notre Dame obviously hoping for a different outcome. UConn won by 21.
And not much left to say about UConn's dominance. The Huskies will be trying to win a third straight championship. So let's try this. Tom, why are they so good?
They get the best players who play for a great coach, Gino Auriemma, who, according to those in the know, pushes those best players mercilessly in practice. I recently spoke with writer Jeff Goldberg, who covered the team for several years in the early 2000s, and he described Auriemma's practices, which sometimes included the five starting players scrimmaging against eight defenders. So it seems 5-on-5 would be a breeze after that, and for UConn, it often is.
So UConn and Notre Dame tomorrow night. Tonight, Wisconsin and Duke. A bit of a surprise that the men's Uber team Kentucky is not there. But of course, Wisconsin took care of the Kentucky Wildcats this weekend. So what can you tell us about tonight's matchup in Indianapolis?
Yeah, close. Vegas odds makers rated even. Against Kentucky, Wisconsin showed the kind of qualities that win close games. They played suffocating defense at big moments and calmly hit the big shots and free throws down the stretch. Duke, on the other hand, has a trio of very good freshmen, including center Jahlil Okafor, who should have a battle royal with Wisconsin big man Frank Kaminsky tonight. Duke also has been playing great defense, holding its tournament opponents to an average of 55 points per game. So it should be a great one. I would give a slight edge to Wisconsin.
But here's something else, Tom. With previously unbeaten Kentucky gone, has that taken some of the luster off this championship game?
Yeah, a little bit, I would say. It would have created the greatest buzz having a 39-0 Kentucky team playing for the perfect record. It would have been the first undefeated season since 1976. And playing against hated rival Duke. Basketball fans will remember the two played one of the classic tournament games in 1992. So, you know, that would have stoked the hype machine for this title game. Ticket prices for the final reportedly fell 15% after Wisconsin beat Kentucky. You know, I was walking around Indianapolis yesterday. I still saw a number of Kentucky fans, but some definitely left early. It was a sad scene at a souvenir stand offering Kentucky gear for 50% off. Still, if Wisconsin and Duke put on the kind of show that's expected, it'll make this game a great ticket.
NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman in Indianapolis, site of tonight's Men's Division I College Basketball Championship game. Tom, thanks.
You bet.
And crowdfunding has the potential to transform how startup businesses raise money from investors. But so far, federal regulators haven't laid out rules that would allow entrepreneurs to ditch the big investors of Wall Street for Main Street. So some states have decided to take action. From Minneapolis, Mike Moen reports.
Help my band record our next album. Please contribute to my child's medical expenses. Those are some typical crowdfunding proposals you might see online these days. But there's one thing the average investor can't do through crowdfunding: buy stake in a private company. However, that policy is under closer scrutiny. With more competition for venture capital funding, equity crowdfunding is getting more attention.
Many people have heard of Kickstarter or Indiegogo in the nonprofit or charitable space. This would allow individuals to use a similar vehicle, but to purchase actual equity in startups that they believe in.
That's Brandon Peterson, a Minnesota lawmaker who has co-sponsored a bill to legalize the practice within state borders. Right now, there are barriers when it comes to investing in startups. Depression-era laws restrict a private company from advertising money-raising efforts to the masses. Those laws were meant to protect non-accredited investors, basically those who don't meet high income levels, from losing their life savings. But Peterson says they're behind the times.
In today's world, we leverage the internet to do so many things and make our lives easier. This is another thing that's leveraging the power of the internet to bring people together around causes that they support.
Congress did approve a law creating a federal framework for equity crowdfunding. The goal was simple: give startups another option to get their ideas off the ground. Supporters say it trumps traditional methods like securing hard-to-get bank loans, tracking down angel investors, or going public and selling stock. But years later, the Securities and Exchange Commission still hasn't finalized rules. That's why Minnesota and at least a dozen other states have either considered or passed their own crowdfunding laws. Crowdfunding supporters say they've been patient long enough. But Adam Pritchard, a securities law professor at the University of Michigan, says the commission is taking a careful approach to protect consumers.
Given the very small amounts that can be raised under crowdfunding, it's going to attract a very large number of people wanting to fund businesses, and doesn't take a lot of money at stake to bring the fraudsters out of the woodwork.
Pritchard adds that the feds are feeling pressure from regulators at the state level. In Minnesota, the Department of Commerce issued a letter when the crowdfunding bill first surfaced, listing concerns including data privacy and recourse for investors who lose a lot of money. The department is now working on a compromise with bill sponsors. That's good news for entrepreneurs like Bob Carney Jr., who says he would take advantage of equity crowdfunding.
This is a tremendous breakthrough in the ability to finance businesses. When you have a group of people that are starting a business, they all have a network of friends, and they have reputations. So this is a chance for groups of people to tap into these networks.
But some experts don't see this as a game changer, especially with the strict caps likely to be placed on how much money can be invested or raised. But for startups that want to get past the idea stage, every dollar helps. For NPR News, I'm Mike Moen in Minneapolis.
And this is NPR News.
Well, I was born like this. I don't have any fingers.
Kevin Lopez could become the first person to get a hand transplant because of a birth defect.
This is a visible transplant, and so raises lots of psychological issues.
Would those and other potential complications be worth a new hand?
These are huge risks, and I hope he fully understands it.
That story later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 3 on Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned for Marketplace at 6:30.
Good morning, I'm Renee Montaigne. Hopping along in the spring tradition, the Houston Zoo held an Easter egg hunt on Friday. Not for the visitors, but for the animals. Giant papier-mâché eggs were filled with meat or veggies. Orangutans cracked theirs open to find bok choy and broccoli. No word if zookeepers jumped into bunny costumes to hide the eggs. The Houston Chronicle reports that the apes did play dress-up with the colorful wrappers after munching on the treats. It's Morning Edition.
It's 8:31. You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Terry Bell. Good morning. Well, everybody's talking about the Wisconsin Badgers playing for the men's college basketball national championship tonight, but there's another big game today. It's opening day for the Milwaukee Brewers, and we'll get you ready in 15 minutes. Also, we invite you to join us tomorrow night at 8 for hourly updates of Wisconsin election results. Again, that's tomorrow night at 8.
Support for WPR comes from St. Mary's Janesville and the Steady Strides Total Joint Replacement Program, dedicated to helping individuals with painful knees and hips get back to enjoying life. Take the first step. More at steadystrides.com.
Support comes from the Racine Literacy Council. Find out about volunteer tutoring opportunities that have flexible and shorter-term schedules. Visit racineliteracy.com or stop by the office on Lake Avenue. The next training sessions for new tutors will be the third and fourth Tuesday evenings in April.
Hi, this is Connie Beam, Senior Advisor for Planned Giving at WPR. If you're a longtime listener like me and believe in the valuable service that Wisconsin Public Radio provides to our state, join me and make a planned gift so WPR is here for future generations. Include WPR in your will, your trust, or by beneficiary designation. For more information, visit WPRlegacy.org. And thank you.
It's going to be a cool day in Wisconsin today, overcast for the most part, with some scattered snow in the north and light rain in the south, and highs mainly in the lower 40s, even cooler near Lake Superior. Right now, Superior 32, La Crosse 37, and Wausau 34, Eau Claire 36, Madison 36, and Green Bay 36. It's 39 in Milwaukee.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Weinstein Company, presenting the new film Woman in Gold, based on the true story about a woman who stopped at nothing to get back what was taken from her family by the Nazi army, starring Helen Mirren and Ryan Reynolds, now playing in select cities. From Lindemood Bell, Lindemood Bell Learning Centers work to help all students reach their potential for learning. Summer programs are available to improve reading and comprehension. Learn more at lindemoodbell.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. Today in your health, two questions about when one should seek medical care. In a moment, why many women don't seek help during a heart attack. First, a medical ritual for millions of Americans, the annual physical. Yearly prodding and poking with questions about exercise and alcohol intake. There is little evidence to show these checkups do any good for healthy adults, and they may be worth skipping altogether, as Jenny Gold reports.
It's a warm afternoon in Miami, and 35-year-old Emmanuel Vega has come to Baptist Health Primary Care for a physical exam. He's a handsome and strapping guy with a thick black beard and square glasses. Dr. Mark Caruso shakes his hand with a welcoming smile.
Mr. Vega, I'm Dr. Caruso. A pleasure to meet you.
Very nice.
And when was your last full diagnostic?
Wow, I don't even remember. Probably 12, 13 years ago.
He says he didn't really feel like he needed to come in.
I've been feeling good. I don't do drugs. I don't drink. My wife went ahead and made the appointment, and I was all about it.
Especially because it's free under his insurance policy, not even a copay. Dr. Caruso starts with the basics.
Open, please. Say ah.
He listens to Vega's heart and lungs, checks the pulse in his ankles, and feels around his lymph nodes. He also asks Vega about his exercise routine. Impressive. His rest schedule could use some work, and orders blood and urine tests. As long as everything checks out all right, they'll do it all again next year.
We'll ask 1 year. Allow us to do this full diagnostic on you.
Yes, sir, of course.
Vega says he'll definitely be back. More than 44 million Americans get a physical exam each year. But as it turns out, the evidence is not on their side, says Dr. Ativ Mehrotra, a professor of health policy at Harvard Medical School.
I would argue that we should move forward with the elimination of the annual physical.
Mehrotra is also a primary care doctor. He says patients should really only go to the doctor if something is wrong, or if it's time for them to have an important test, like a colonoscopy.
When I, as a doctor, say I do not advocate for the annual physical, I feel like I'm, you know, attacking moms and apple pie here. It seems so intuitive and so straightforward and something that's been part of medicine for such a long time.
But he says randomized trials going all the way back to the 1980s just don't support it.
They don't really help patients.
The Society for General Internal Medicine even put annual physicals on a list of things doctors should avoid completely for healthy adults. One problem, Mehrotra says, is the cost. Each visit usually costs just $150. But with so many people coming in every year, that adds up fast.
We estimate that it's about $10 billion a year, which is more than how much we spend as a society on breast cancer care. It's a lot of money.
And then there's the risk that a doctor will run a test and find a problem that's not actually there. It's called a false positive, and it can lead to a cascade of follow-up tests that can be expensive and could even cause real harm. Dr. Michael Rothberg is a health researcher at the Cleveland Clinic. He says as a doctor, he generally avoids giving physicals.
I generally don't like to frighten people, and I, you know, mostly tell my family if they're feeling well to stay away from doctors because, you know, if you get near them, then they're going to start to look for things and order tests because that's what doctors do.
Back in Miami, Dr. Caruso is also well-versed in the research on annual physicals, but he still believes in them.
I think having a look at somebody is worth its weight in gold.
He says it's an important part of developing a relationship with a patient. And there have been countless times when he's found real problems during an exam just like the one he gave to Emmanuel Vega.
What if Mr. Vega had had a lump or bump that wasn't right? What if when he had his shirt off, Mr. Vega said, oh yeah, I forgot to mention this spot on my chest, and it ended up being a melanoma that we discover early?
The federal government seems to agree. The Affordable Care Act requires all insurance plans to cover annual physicals at zero cost to patients. For NPR News, I'm Jenny Gold.
Jenny Gold is a reporter with our partner, the nonprofit news service Kaiser Health News. And now we turn to a group of people who don't seek medical care enough. Women, especially young women who are having a heart attack. Women under the age of 55 are twice as likely as men to die after being hospitalized for a heart attack. And as Manvi Singh reports, part of the problem is that women often don't realize what's happening.
Christina Costanzo was 32 when she had her first heart attack. It all started on a Friday.
I had chest pain. I had pain in my jaw. I had some shortness of breath.
And even though Costanzo was a nurse practitioner, she didn't realize right away that this was her heart. She figured it was just her body reacting to stress, and she didn't want to overreact.
I did not want to go to the emergency room, sit there for hours, only to be sent home and told, you know, there was nothing wrong with me. So I just waited until Monday and saw my primary care.
That's when she discovered that she had had a heart attack, a big one. Costanzo's story isn't unique. Studies show that women tend to wait much longer than men to get emergency care for heart attacks. And once they do go to the ER, their symptoms are often misdiagnosed. In a recent study, Judith Lichtman, an epidemiologist at the Yale School of Public Health, tried to figure out why. She interviewed 30 women, ages 30 to 55, who had been hospitalized after a heart attack. It turned out that many didn't really know what a heart attack felt like.
We often see it portrayed as someone falling to their knees, holding on to their chest.
In reality, along with some chest pain, most women tend to experience other symptoms.
Things like neck pain, jaw pain, indigestion, fatigue.
Even when they suspected that they were having a heart attack, many women said that they were hesitant to bring it up.
Many of them said that they were concerned about being wrong or having a false alarm.
And doctors often reinforced women's fears, automatically assuming that they were suffering from indigestion or maybe panic attack rather than a heart attack.
I think it is really critical to empower women to not feel any stigma or judgment.
And she says doctors should do a better job of listening and pay special attention to women who have high blood pressure or cholesterol or a family history of heart disease. For NPR News, I'm Manvi Singh.
Support for your health comes from Athena Health, committed to helping physicians manage industry change and transition to ICD-10 by the October 2015 deadline at athenahealth.com. And from Novo Nordisk, committed to providing resources for support and education to the bleeding disorders community. More at mynovosecure.com.
And this is Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's 8:41. You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Terry Bell. Good morning. Pop quiz. Can you guess how many billionaires there are in the world? We'll have the answer 10 minutes from now on the Marketplace Morning Report. Our weather today, overcast and cold, with scattered snow in the north and light rain in the south, with highs mainly in the lower 40s, cooler near Lake Superior.
When composer Philip Glass first started performing his music, it was so different and new that sometimes audiences would get angry. So angry, they'd throw things.
If they threw apples and oranges, that wasn't so great. If they threw an egg, it isn't so bad, because the eggs would just break. No, that could be...
He's our guest on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
Right after Marketplace, tonight at 7 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. California Governor Jerry Brown says his historic statewide water conservation mandate is an act of necessity, not only for agricultural production, but for those who supply the field-to-table labor.
Farm workers who are at the very low end of the economic scale here are out of work. There are people in agriculture areas that are really suffering. We're providing food.
Brown spoke on ABC's This Week. Rolling Stone magazine has officially apologized and retracted a discredited piece about an alleged gang rape at the University of Virginia. This following a report by the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, conclusion, Rolling Stone failed to serve the basic needs of fairness and accuracy. The finance minister of Greece meets with U.S. Treasury officials in Washington today. Joanna Kakissis explains.
Finance Minister Yanis Varoufakis met with International Monetary Fund Director Christine Lagarde on Sunday night. Greece owes the IMF money this week, but the government is also facing a cash crunch. Varoufakis is hoping the U.S. may be an ally. Greece remains locked in difficult bailout negotiations with the Eurozone.
Prime Minister Narendra Modi is saying India will not accede to international pressure to reduce carbon emissions. India is the third largest source of greenhouse gases. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell. Madison police say they will make arrests soon in the case of hate graffiti on some West Side homes in February. More than two dozen Madison families found profane language, ethnic and racial slurs spray-painted on their homes on Valentine's Day. Investigating officers say more than 30 homes were vandalized. Police say no one has been charged yet, and they haven't released an estimate of how many people they think may have been involved. While most of the tagging involved vulgar language, some included racially based and anti-Semitic slurs and swastikas.
The University of Wisconsin men's basketball team plays for a national championship tonight. The Badgers spoiled Kentucky's historic run in Saturday night's semifinal and will be trying to win Wisconsin's first title in basketball since 1941. The game should be full of intriguing matchups, from Wisconsin head coach Bo Ryan matching wits with Duke's Mike Krzyzewski, and two of the game's brightest stars going at the paint in Wisconsin's Frank Kaminsky and Duke's Jahlil Okafor. Tip-off is scheduled for 8:18 Wisconsin time. People living Pleasant Prairie say they're fighting to head off the end of their local drive-in theater. They say the Kino Drive-In Theater is an iconic local landmark and needs to be preserved. Needed digital equipment for upgrades would cost an estimated $100,000. New plans could be approved by next month. If the big spring comes down, only 9 drive-in theaters would be left in Wisconsin. I'm Terry Bell.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years. From Kaspersky, giving 400 million individuals and organizations the power to protect against cybercriminals, hackers, and other internet threats. Learn more at Kaspersky.com. That's Kaspersky.com. And from the Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and developing countries. On the web at lemelson.org.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and it's opening day for the Milwaukee Brewers. They'll take on the Colorado Rockies this afternoon at Miller Park. Players and fans are anxious to shake off last year's historic season-ending collapse and make a sustained run for the playoffs in 2015. Joining us now for a preview of the baseball season is the voice of the Milwaukee Brewers, Joe Block. Good morning.
Good morning.
Joe, this is mostly the same team that suffered that epic collapse at the end of last year that we're all familiar with by now, but why no major changes in the offseason?
Well, I disagree with that. I think the Brewers have made several changes. In fact, a couple of the guys that they brought in at the end of the year with Gerardo Parra and Jonathan Broxton to try to improve their chances of making the postseason, that's different than the team that started last year, as well as going out and getting Adam Lind. You know, finally, really for the first time in the last 3 years, they've gotten an everyday first baseman with a track record.
Yeah, a good baseball team is strong up the middle. Jonathan Lucroy, a catcher, center fielder Carlos Gomez can be counted on. Gene Segura at shortstop and second baseman Scooter Gennett, they maybe have a little more to prove.
I disagree there too. Scooter Gennett's a 300 career hitter.
I'm too.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, that's just my opinion. But, you know, Jeanette's been a 300 career hitter, and, you know, he's proven he can hit left-handers in the minor leagues. I don't think that's going to be an issue, him playing every day this year. And Segura, a past All-Star already in his first full season. Now, he wasn't to that form last year, of course, but it looks like he's stinging the ball a lot better this year and hitting gaps with line drives. And that was kind of what he was doing, taking the ball to all fields in that 13 season. So he's closer to that than we've seen at any point last year. So I think those guys, not only defensively, especially with Segura, but offensively too, are going to be among the better double play combinations in the National League. And as you mentioned, yeah, I will agree with you, Terry. Yes, Gomez and Lucroy up the middle are all-stars, and the Brewers are lucky to have those guys too.
Longtime ace Yovani Gallardo is gone. There is a starting rotation of 5. Do we have enough pitchers to get through that long baseball season?
Well, that is a question. You know, right now the 5 that they've got in the rotation are all solid and guys that they're counting on. So if you're the Brewers and you're trying to figure out who your 6th or 7th starter is, that's probably a pretty good problem to have. But for the most part, teams don't have the luxury of employing, you know, 7 or 8 starting pitchers that they think might all be able to contribute in the event of an injury.
Francisco Rodriguez is back, but can the Brewers count on him to be the closer?
Well, he saved 44 games last year and only blew 5 of them. So, you know, the home runs were an interesting part of his mix last year. I think just about any closer in baseball is going to give you some intrigue. But what was interesting about him is not only his success rate overall, but also the fact that in half of his outings last year, he faced the minimum, half of his save chances. So he did make a lot of 1-2-3 saves. And, of course, no one talks about those because he just did his job. But he's an all-star, and he'll be back this year.
As much as the Brewers may have maintained over the offseason, you could argue some of the other teams in their division got better.
Oh, absolutely. I think the Cubs improved. Pittsburgh continues to add depth The Cardinals are always going to be in the mix. I don't know if the Reds improved, but they are going to be healthier, it seems like, this year, and that should help them at least be more competitive in the division this year.
It's good to have baseball back.
Absolutely. That's one thing we can agree on, Terry.
Okay, Joe Block, the voice of the Milwaukee Brewers. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, always my pleasure.
If I pitch, can you catch? Will you hold the ball when you step to the plate? Will you swing and fall if you play? You gotta know.
And you're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10 minutes before 9 o'clock. That means the best in classical music comes your way right after the Marketplace Morning Report, which is coming up next.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the Danish Brotherhood's annual Think Spring Breakfast will take place Sunday, April 12th. Breakfast includes Danish pancakes, sausage, kringle, and coffee. Proceeds benefit the Brotherhood Scholarship Fund. The lodge is at 2206 63rd Street, Kenosha.
WPR is pleased to support films and filmmakers from Wisconsin and around the world. For more information, visit WPR.org/events.
It should be a chilly day in Wisconsin today. Overcast skies, some scattered snow in the north, and light rain in the south, with highs mainly in the lower 40s, upper 30s for highs near Lake Superior. We expect cool weather with a chance of rain all week long.
Support for WPR comes from Lynn's on Odana Road in Madison, dedicated to providing creative people with art supplies, picture framing, and needlework supplies, including fabrics, fibers, and charts for more than 30 years. Lynnsofmadison.com.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Althaus, honoring personal legacies in the circle of life. They believe that every detail counts and every memory matters. Piasecki Althaus is located in Kenosha on 39th Avenue, serving the community since 1931.
Markets react to the not-so-good Friday jobs report.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Constant Contact, a proud Marketplace sponsor for 7 years, committed to helping small businesses succeed with email marketing. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. And by the University of Southern California.
From APM in New York, I'm David Brancaccio. Players in financial markets are getting a chance this morning to react to the Friday employment report showing the economy added a disappointing 126,000 jobs in March. 21 minutes into the trading day, here are some numbers. The S&P 500 is down 0.4% at 2,058, but the Dow at the moment is down 9 points, not quite a 0.1%. NASDAQ Composite is up 0.2%. The dollar is down sharply. A euro costs more than $1.10 now. The 10-year Treasury yield is up slightly at 1.85%. European markets are closed for Easter Monday. Now let's consult Quincy Crosby, market strategist with Prudential Financial. Good morning.
Good morning, David.
Some of this weakness this morning has got to be the big dogs taking Easter Monday off.
Absolutely. Europe is closed. You've got some markets down in South America, Latin America closed. It means the volume is down. No one is going to take a big bet, but we work. Our market is open today, so it'll be kind of quiet.
Now, Quincy, today is the day of reckoning after that weak jobs report on Friday. The stock market was closed on Good Friday, except for a brief stretch of futures trading. But what do you think? Is the economy really all that bad?
Look, the data that we had really did indicate there was a slowdown, but we call it a soft patch. But we're beginning to see, David, a pickup. Vehicle sales. We saw the number, and we do this on an annualized basis, 17.1 million vehicles sold in the U.S. for March. This means that Americans are saying, I feel confident enough to buy this vehicle. Rail car loadings. That's an indication that stuff is going across this country, and that number moved up as well. Unemployment claims down, and we're going into the earnings season, David, and as you know, for the market, it is about earnings. It is about what companies tell us that they are expecting, and so the focus of the market is going to shift fairly rapidly.
Yes, the first big profits report due from Alcoa later in the week. Quincy Crosby, Prudential Financial, thank you so much.
Thank you, David. Take care.
Also, Saudi Arabia is raising crude oil prices for customers in Asia after signs that demand is up. Crude using the Texas price this morning is up 2.2%. Now to traffic casting using big data. Microsoft is helping researchers in Brazil study whether they can predict traffic snarls 15 minutes to an hour before they happen.
Predicting the future sounds like a sci-fi movie, sort of like Minority Report. Remember that one?
All right, what he's doing now, we call scrubbing the image, looking for clues as to where the murder is going to happen.
Substitute murder plots with traffic jams, and that's pretty much what researchers in Brazil want to do with Microsoft's computing help. That's according to a video featuring Juliana Salas of Microsoft Research.
The Traffic Prediction Project uses data available by social networks, Department of Transportation, and data that the users create themselves while they move around the city.
That's great, but that data isn't new, so haven't we done the predicting thing already?
It is being done now. It can always be done better.
Peter Keen runs digital traffic systems. They provide some of the traffic data you see on apps like Google Maps. He says right now, predicting traffic relies on the past.
You have historical trends of what the volume is going to be on a given day of the week at a given time of day.
What we don't have, Keen says, is a way to combine past and current statistics. And that's where Microsoft comes in with its cloud computing power to crunch all that data. I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
Another story we're following this morning, Greece. It owes $500 million to the International Monetary Fund with a deadline looming on Thursday. IMF head Christine Lagarde spent part of her Easter Sunday meeting with Greece's finance minister, who promises Greece will pay everything it owes.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Angie's List, with reviews of local companies to help users buy services and achieve their goals of remodeled kitchens, freshly painted houses, or new backyards. Angie'sList.com. And by Robert W. Baird & Company, a financial partner keeping clients' best interests in mind since 1919. BairdWealth.com has more information. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
Time for a set of fiendishly confounding questions about the global economy in the form of a quiz. Stefan Richter, editor-in-chief of The Globalist, is here to teach us something about our globalized world. Good to connect with you, Stefan.
Hi, David. Today you're in for a little bit of Piketology. We all remember Thomas Piketty and his by now famous book, Capital in the 21st Century. Now, I don't want anybody to get engaged in the ideological or intellectual debate. I have a very simple question.
Okay.
How many billionaires are there in the world? Is it 13.7 million people? Is it 3.1 million? Is it just 2,325 or only 286?
How about it's the one that was in the 2000s, 2,300 billionaires in the world?
That's exactly right, 2,325. Now, to see how well billionaires have done just after the financial crisis, their number globally was down to 1,360 billionaires. It's risen by now by over 70%. There are six countries, U.S., China, U.K., Germany, Russia, and India in that sequence, that account for more than half of all the world's 2,300-some billionaires. And China's rate is rising more quickly than even that in the U.S. Russia still has quite a few, but in view of the recent sanctions, Russia is going to go down. Probably Switzerland may take its place at some point. There's been a race back and forward between those two countries. But that's the global view.
Now, one of the wrong answers was 286. I know you. You usually choose your possible answers for a reason. Why that number?
To represent more than 50, around 50% of humanity, that's 286 women who are billionaires. The richest of them is Christy Walton, the daughter-in-law of Sam Walton. And, you know, that's still quite a number, but only 12% of the world's billionaires. So women have quite some place to go.
All right, Stefan Richter tweets at The Globalist. Stefan, thank you.
Good to talk with you.
The Waltons is a family that put the wall into Walmart, of course. And the Wall Street Journal crunched the numbers and revealed today that the gap between the pay of bank CEOs in the U.S. and the pay of everyone else at their banks has shrunk since the financial crisis. In 2006, CEOs made 273 times the average employee salary at their banks. Now it's 124 times. Separate studies have shown that, for instance, in Japan, the CEO pay ratio across all industries is 11 to 1. This is the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
And I'm Norman Gilliland, in for Stephanie Elkins on this Monday. We'll have, in the hour to come, music to include something by one Baldassare Galuppi, famous not just for his own music, but for a poem by Robert Browning. Also, some Bagatelles by Dvorak here on WPR.
When you listen to Wisconsin Public Radio, you're enjoying the results of membership support. 50,000 members help make this unique radio service possible. You can learn more about WPR and all of our programs by visiting WPR.org.
Support comes from the Racine Literacy Council, celebrating 50 years of providing literacy programs. More tutors are needed to work with adults on their waiting list. Volunteering may be especially appealing to current and retired teachers, high school juniors and seniors, and college students. RacineLiteracy.com.